Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein for another conversation. Today we have Ashley Berner with us. Ashley is the Deputy Director of the Johns Hopkins Institute for Education Policy. She's an Associate Professor of Johns Hopkins Education. Her book, Pluralism and American Public Education, No One Way to School, came out in 2017. That forms the basis for our conversation today. Ashley, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Mark.
Well, we're just going to talk about public schools, private schools, what we need, and everyone's convinced that we need things. We need change. We're always in a position of needing educational reform, right? Has there ever been a time, Ashley, in our lives when we didn't need education reform?
That as a matter of objective fact, probably not. As a matter of perception, certainly not.
Right. I mean, George W. Bush was, but before 9/11, he was, quote, the education president, right?
Correct.
Wasn't that his? Yeah. Okay, so, first, some definitions. What is education pluralism, the key term in your title?
So educational pluralism is just a different way to structure public education than we're accustomed to here in the United States. So most democracies create a structure for schooling in which the government funds and regulates, but doesn't necessarily deliver public education. So, and for example, the Netherlands funds 36 different kinds of schools on equal footing, Catholic, Jewish, Socialist, Montessori, and so on, and holds them all accountable for academic results. Canada, most provinces of Canada do, Sweden does, Denmark, Belgium, the UK, Australia. In fact, most democracies structure public education in this way.
It's interesting. These are pretty secular states that you mentioned, and they have no problem with taxes going to fund religious schools.
Well, that's correct. In fact, the Netherlands, which is the most expansive in terms of the types of schools it funds, has had a secular constitution since the late 18th century. I think because the argument isn't primarily a religious argument. The argument for educational pluralism there are several arguments. The first is that education isn't neutral, that it can't be philosophically neutral, that in fact every single element of a school, whether it's the curriculum or the hiring practices, the disciplinary code, all of these are selected in some fashion and aren't neutral. And that's not nefarious. It's simply the way human institutions work. So since there's no such thing as neutrality when it comes to schooling, the theory goes, we should fund diverse school types. To your question about religious schools, in Sweden, which now allows per capita funding to follow the child, very small percentage of the non-state-run schools are religious. It's 4 or 5%. Most of them are secular.
You know, you mentioned that in these states, you get funding coming from the state for these schools, but the schools do have to demonstrate academic results, correct? That they are tested?
That's most of them are tested. So here again, the theory is that unlike many other choices that we make as individuals, that schooling and education really, it's not just an individual good. It's not only an individual good, it's also a common good. In that it matters to me how your child has, you know, the opportunities that your child has to advance, to be whoever he or she wants to be. And it matters to you that my children understand the democratic process and so forth. So we're all in schooling together, as it were. And in fact, the primary justification for, at least in democracies, for state funding for education in the first place was to provide the academic and civic formation for the next generation of citizens. So the way that most plural democracies manage the common good of education is to say, whatever kind of school you attend, you need to learn some of the same content. And it takes different forms in different countries, but the majority require a certain amount of academic content to be taught in every grade and then have commensurate assessments that see if the child or all the children in a school have mastered the content.
And that's where you get the academic results. You're testing schools on that common academic content. In math, we know, a certain degree of algebra at a certain age, and so on. And all schools, all kids in the schools, do they get assessed on the same content?
Yes, they do. In many of these countries, again, it differs. Sweden doesn't have this, which is maybe one reason why Sweden's academic results are not as strong as they used to be. But the interesting thing is when we look at educational research about what in-school factors make the largest difference in student outcomes, whether they're academic or civic, the two factors that come up again and again and again are a strong, intellectually demanding, coherent curriculum. So it's the academic piece. And number two, it's the school culture piece. This comes in the United States from James Coleman and Tony Bright's studies of the Catholic high school effect, of what is it that has made Catholic high schools historically so capable of closing academic achievement gaps and frankly, sponsoring civic behaviors. We can talk more about the civic behaviors if you want, but pluralism has an innate advantage in that, unlike a uniform structure for schooling, for public schooling, pluralism by definition does not seek to have all schools be uniform in terms of values and norms.
And in these other countries, do you have the curriculum wars of the kind that we see in the United States? For instance, U.S. history, what does that mean? Does that mean, a more progressivist or identity, from the bottom up U.S. history? Or are we talking more top down, sort of military history, diplomatic history, and so on? They don't have those kinds of curriculum debates, or at least not as fiercely as we do?
It depends on the country. It's very interesting. The English-speaking countries, by this I'm talking, of course, about the UK and Australia and Canada and the US, in the early 20th century, shied away from a liberal arts curriculum and moved towards a very progressive notion of what education was, that it's what we would say today, learning how to learn rather than learning something in particular, sort of skills-based. And things were so bad in some of the provinces of Canada, for example, that by the 1950s, only two courses were required for high school graduation. And you asked about history. The Canadian history courses focused on psychological history. And it became just so obvious that the province actually in the 1980s underwent a transformation in which I would call it politically a grand bargain, that the Alberta province was able to do three things simultaneously. Number one, they reoriented property taxes so that your schools, that the property tax was centralized as opposed to local funding for schools, which was huge, huge point for equity. That would be a great move in this country. Number two, they put in place a really robust content-rich curriculum and assessments across the curriculum. And number three, they expanded pluralism. So whereas Alberta used to just fund secular and Protestant and Catholic schools, they expanded to not only Inuit schools, Jewish schools, Islamic schools, more secular schools, but also homeschooling. So homeschoolers get a stipend in Alberta. And so there was certainly conflict there. Sweden and France, as you know, have gone in the opposite direction, that France is E.D. Hirsch's the seventh chapter of his book Why Knowledge Matters talks about the deterioration of the French intellectual curriculum into a skills-based standing, and that it's had such a negative effect upon student learning, particularly low-income kids. Same with Sweden. Sweden did something remarkable about 20 years ago, that they allowed municipalities to create a per capita funding mechanism for students so that the money follows the child, which sounds quite glorious. And in fact, and it is, but at the same time, the same Swedish government mandated that all schools teach a progressive style curriculum. So, you know, it's just it, there's not an even track. And what I've it's, so my background's in history, and what I look at when I look at the history of different school systems, I want to circle back to what you said at the beginning. Is there ever a time when we don't need to improve? And the answer is a resounding no. There's always conflict about the content and the structure.
One thing is the increased immigration in Europe in the last few years putting pressure on for actually more standardization?
It depends on what you mean by standardization. They've always, in the main, had quite robust intellectual curricula, with some exceptions. The real pressure has been on the social cohesion side, and governments have begun to promote citizenship education and change the way that they manage adults in the system to ensure that they are more civically literate. In terms of the pressure that's on the curriculum, there has only been one instance that I know of in Europe in which some concern for some of the Islamic textbooks that were used in Islamic schools that had been published abroad in countries and by publishers that had quite rejected liberal democracy. And so the government, I think this was in the Netherlands, changed the law to mandate all curricular materials needed to be vetted and published in the state of the Netherlands. But they still allow differentiation with respect to materials and teacher prep and so on.
Okay, so this is something that can be worked out. It's always a judgment call on a certain degree of civic uniformity, just given the laws and the history of particular countries. And then within that, we've got a lot of wiggle room for different religion, different literature. The softer areas outside the hard sciences, yes?
Well, that's right. And I think what we've seen is, again, that the curriculum plays an important role in civic formation. That we talk a lot in the States about action civics and project-based learning and so on with civics, which is absolutely important and vital. But it's interesting. I was just looking at Alberta, Canada's social studies curriculum, and even where they have project-based learning in social studies curricula, for example, should Canada build, you know, should we build a trans-Canadian pipeline, for example? Students have to answer those questions in those projects with reference to the laws, the structure of the federal government, and the role of the media and so forth. It's very concrete and very specific. That is vital, as is good writing, by the way. The ability to actually form a letter to a congressman it doesn't arise from nothing. It comes from careful study of grammar and expression. Interestingly, I will say this about Alberta, since I just mentioned it. I said a minute ago about the common content that can be delivered through different school culture lenses. The Catholic materials for social studies look different and have a different appeal than the same set of information delivered in a secular textbook. So it's that kind of nuance that makes a strong school culture and an academic curriculum possible.
We're never going to get in this country, though, any public funding for religious schools, are we?
Oh, sure, we have it.
How does that work?
So there are several mechanisms that allow funding, public funding, to follow a child to the school of his or her choice, and it can be religious. So there are the three mechanisms. The first one, the most common, is a tax credit, in which this is a piece of state legislation that allows corporations and individuals to have a break on their tax liability, which they can give as a donation to a scholarship-granting organization that then provides funding for low-income students. It's almost always means-tested, which I think is a very good thing. The tax credit allows that money to follow a child who's from a low-income family to attend a private school. That does not the Supreme Court has ruled that tax credits are never considered public funding. And so it's not a breach of the federal or so far, it's not a tax credit has not been condemned as against any state constitution except in Montana right now. There's a case that's looking at it's a bit more nuanced than that. But tax credits are a constitutional mechanism. Vouchers is where the state Department of Education, or in some cases a district, but it's usually the state, allows a percentage, usually, I don't know, it can be very low or very high, a percentage of per child funding that's public funds to go with the child to a private school, can be a religious school. Vouchers are constitutionally legal from a federal perspective if the funding mechanism is neutral with respect to religion. In other words, it wouldn't pass muster if Maryland said, oh, we're going to fund Catholic schools per se. It has to be neutral on its face. It has to engage with choice. It has to go towards the parent, and it's the parent's choice. It doesn't go directly to the school.
So the argument there would be, if someone can take a voucher money to a private school that is not religious, we can't penalize religious schools by saying, but you can't do it at a religious school.
That's actually the issue. That's the issue in the Montana case right now that the Supreme Court may be hearing, because the Supreme Court's been fairly strict that if you have a general program, you cannot exclude, if it's open to all comers, you cannot exclude religious schools or religious entities. And that's a very strong body of jurisprudence. But Montana has argued that the Montana State Supreme Court has struck down a tax credit program that included religious schools.
On the basis of a separation issue?
This is the other historical piece that always needs to be discussed at this juncture. There are 30-some state constitutions that have built in a direct injunction against funding religious schools.
In any way?
Well, not necessarily. Some have the language of direct or indirect. So the origins of these clauses are from the 19th century anti-Catholic, anti-immigrant movement. I mean, this is a point that bears saying that the United States used to have a pluralist structure for our schools. We used to fund Catholic schools, Calvinist schools, Congregationalist schools, and secular schools, and in fact, de facto Jewish schools in some of the boroughs of New York City. But when Catholic immigrants increased in the mid-19th century, the Protestant majority fundamentally did not believe that Catholics could become good democratic citizens.
They're taking orders from Rome, you know.
Well, that's exactly it. It's the assumption that there is a foreign loyalty to a foreign power, and the hierarchical worship and structure of the Catholic Church didn't sit well with the individualism of American Protestants. So, I mean, this is it's a fascinating, in my mind, terrible consequence, where you had the Ku Klux Klan firebombing Catholic churches and neighborhoods and Protestants marching in the streets of Philadelphia against funding for Catholic schools. So there's a lot more to that story, but the bottom line is that by the end of the 19th century, many states had put a restriction against funding for religious schools in their state constitutions. It has to be said that the resulting common schools were Protestant in nature. I mean, this cultural majority don't realize and don't see themselves as such. They can say with a straight face that they're neutral, but at the same time passing laws requiring Protestant prayers, Protestant Bible, and so on.
Actually, in recent years, do we see that jurisprudence, those laws from a century ago, are they starting to erode?
I don't see that they are eroding yet. I think that's the next. Certainly, there are a lot of institutions that are working to push against the Blaine Amendments. Almost all of the cases that have made it to the Supreme Court, the Zelman case that actually decided that a voucher in a Blaine Amendment state, it happened to be Ohio, the Blaine Amendment in Ohio because it only said direct funding to religious schools is forbidden, not indirect, that Ohio's voucher program could stand. But they haven't, the Supreme Court has not to this point ruled directly on the Blaine Amendments.
Betsy DeVos is a big fan of vouchers, correct?
Correct.
Is the Trump Education Department working to spread the voucher programs?
She certainly is using the bully pulpit, and the department now has is on board with a legislative initiative a congressional initiative to have a federal tax credit. It puts the Trump administration in a bit of a bind, since it does allocate more, I would say, passive authority in the hands of the federal government. And I don't think that it will go anywhere personally, politically. But yes, Betsy DeVos has been, as an individual, one of the country's greatest champions of educational freedom for low-income students. I think she's in a bit of a different situation now, in that she needs to be supporting all different types of schools, not only private schools. And I think this is the other interesting thing. When I look at pluralistic countries, they don't tend to pit entire sectors against one another. They don't tend to study, quote, the Catholic school effect. And I find that appealing. I long for that. It's in our political discourse, you've got charter schools and district schools condemning one another. You've got the failing schools model. I don't believe that's right or necessary.
Where do the unions stand on the voucher issue?
In the United States?
Yes.
They have a very strong stand against vouchers.
It takes money out of public schools?
Does it? Not necessarily. I think there are some fairly careful fiscal analyses of the consequences of choice programs. And they're, in the main, they are net positive for the state, always for the state, sometimes for the district. Florida, there's a very interesting study of Miami-Dade, in which, because Florida has a lot of choice mechanisms, there are a lot of options for low-income children. And David Figlio, who's the dean at Northwestern School of Education, did some fascinating studies that showed that the effect of having a lot of options meant that there were fewer students who remained in district schools. These students tended to be higher performing students, and they ended up with a lot more instructional resources being given to them, and their test scores went up on the state exams, as did the test scores of the typically lower performing students who went to the private schools. But this, again, it so much depends, so much of the result that you get depends upon the program design.
It seems to me that the vouchers and the charter, just the pluralism in general, it just makes the system more fluid, and that this is going to, I mean, parents have more freedom to move their kids around, and you get the lower performing schools and people, not that they become sort of phased out, but in a way it gets a lot of dissatisfaction out of the system, or it's a way of dealing with dissatisfaction in a way that just the one model, the uniformity, often just builds dissatisfaction.
Well, I think it builds inequity as well, because there are 1,000 different reasons why a given school might not work for a particular child. It might have nothing to do with religious belief. It might have to do with the size of the school. And so even the best resourced district school or Catholic school or Jewish school is not going to be the best fit for every child. I love the word that you use there, fluid. This puts me in mind of a debate that occurred in the UK in the House of Parliament. There was a dispute about religious school funding. Religious schools have been built into the UK's legislation for a very, very, very long time. In fact, the first grant that Parliament made to public education in general in 1834 was channeled through Catholic and Anglican schools. So religious schools aren't going to go away. But there was an argument from a secular party that the UK should defund religious schools. And religious schools were defended by a Labour member from Hull who talked about the neighborhoods that he serves that had been historically Catholic and so attracted Catholic schools. And as the demography of those neighborhoods has shifted towards immigrants and towards more Islamic students, the school has maintained a space for both Catholic and Muslim kids. They have some secular subjects in common. They separate for classes that engage directly with worldview. And that's the kind of fluidity that's possible when you're not assuming that public education means one thing. I think that's actually the biggest barrier we face, Mark, with pluralism is the longstanding cultural identification of public schooling with the district school. That's a norm. It was fought over 100 years ago, and it's become a norm. We assume it. And so the antipathy of public versus private, that most countries don't have to frame things in that way. Part of what I'm trying to do and what our institute's trying to do with our research around pluralism is to open up the space for everyone.
Well, charters have been an extraordinary step in that direction, correct?
Absolutely have. They have been a vital, and I hope will continue to grow as a sector. And we know, again, that there are different results depending on the way the state laws are structured.
But the thing about the fluidity there is bad charters don't last, right?
That's exactly right. Although it must be said that charter authorizers and charter providers are every bit as subject to corruption as any other school sector. Ask anyone in Ohio. It took them 10 years to restructure their charter laws to actually get rid of low performing schools. So, you know, that took a long while because of the legislative relationships, shall we say, that the charter community had.
But lessons are being learned?
Lessons are being learned. Credo is the largest, it's at Stanford. It's a Stanford research center that looks at charter school effects. And it's very clear that lower performing charters are closing across the country and that the higher performing sectors, the higher performing networks, I should say, in states that have strong authorizing laws, in Boston, for example, virtually eliminating the achievement gaps between wealthy and poor kids. It's unbelievable. Incidentally, another sector that's becoming smaller are the fundamentalist evangelical schools. That's from a different body of work. And possibly for the same reason, the quality, parents are becoming savvier in asking about the quality of the academic outcomes.
When we have the pluralism, we also, I imagine, can get better research findings because we can do things like have more variety of curricula. And then we can look at outcomes over many years' time. I know it's hard to control for all the million variables, but does the more diverse, the more pluralistic system allow us to advance the study of education?
It could. I think it's not necessary to improve the research. Our institute's doing a study right now of a high quality curriculum that's been put in district schools, and in North Carolina, actually. And to be sure, you always, as a research team, have to be mindful of selection bias and controlling for exogenous factors and so on. But there's an awful lot of research going on in all different school sectors right now. In highly pluralistic schools, they've taken the school sector competition off the table, and they can focus on the curriculum effect or the school effect by individual schools. And I mean, for example, I've spoken with researchers who are running major institutes for research in the UK and asked them, have you ever studied the Catholic school effect in the UK? Nobody's ever asked them that question. Because they're asking different questions. They're asking how this particular curriculum works across different school types. They're asking about this particular tutorial program. And by the way, one of the accountability measures in most OECD countries is a really rich site visit to individual schools that is, if it's done well, it does drive continuous improvement across all different school types.
Right, right. All right, so are we going to see, final question, Ashley, are we going to see a lot more pluralism 10 years from now?
That's my goal. I certainly hope so.
Okay, okay. Thank you, Ashley. Let me mention your book. Ashley, tell us the title of your book again.
Pluralism in American Public Education, No One Way to School.
Very good. Thank you, Ashley.
Thanks, Mark.